Go. Okay, so hello everybody. We are back for the 6th out of 10 episodes on the podcast mini-series. So today I have with me Bobby Healy, who is the CEO and founder of Mana Drone Delivery. So Bobby, would you like to introduce yourself and explain what Mana Drone Delivery actually is?
Well, it's what it says on the tin, really. So we design and build our own autonomous flying robots that carry everyday goods from directly from restaurants, from stores in suburban communities, directly to people's homes by flying to a GPS point, descending to about 60 feet and winching the product down onto the ground. So we're live in a number of locations. We're on our fifth location now in Texas, in Dallas. And obviously we started in Ireland and Dublin, going actually to Blanchardstown next week is the latest date.
Fantastic. Yeah, so like as you were saying, so like when did you kind of get started with this? Because this is a brand that I've been kind of following for a few years now. I'm mad to see drone delivery in Limerick. I think that would be absolutely class. What I really like is the fact that it's, you know, it's a green solution. It takes cars off the road. It's really quick, and I've seen seen one of your drones in person. They're beasts in comparison to when people see like the DJI Max, what most people find common. So I suppose it'd be a good place to start would be like, where did you get started? How did you get started? Why did you get started? And kind of suss that out.
Yeah, well, to me, it's always been obvious that road-based delivery doesn't work very well. It's slow, it's dangerous. The product arrives never hot and unpredictable times, particularly when the weather's bad. The demand goes through the roof, but supply, i.e. of people, drivers or bikers willing to bring products around, you know, shrinks. So there's a kind of a terrible situation where everybody wants delivery of hot food or different things from their local retailers, but they can't really get them, or they can't get them in a way that makes them happy or that's reliable. And the driver, the delivery driver, not doing great out of it either. And the restaurant and vendors are not doing great. No one's happy with it, but yet there's 5.1 billion food deliveries a year delivered by the top four delivery aggregators, growing 50%. So it's a huge industry. And we looked at that and we said, technology could be applied here technology and physics could be applied here to fix this and to buy products rather than to use the road for them, because the road is constrained, it's two-dimensional, very constrained. There's traffic lights to coordinate, the road space. Whereas the airspace is three-dimensional, so there's far more throughput in the airspace, and you have a different approach to the decongesting airspace that's much more efficient. On paper, flying robots is a much more sensible way to move products around suburban communities than the road. That was the primary thing. And then, we're 5 years now. It takes a long time to build a company like this. We've been flying commercially for over 3 years. So just before COVID started, we flew in Oranmore, Moneygall, then Oranmore, Balbriggan, and now Blanchardstown. And it takes a long time because the business that we're in is essentially it's aerospace. So you're building aerospace grade aircraft that have to be approved by aviation regulators. And they will apply a lens that is very much about safety and reliability at scale. So it is hard. It takes a lot of money and a lot of time and specialist skills to get to viability. I like that because it's so hard that there's really nobody else in the world doing it. There's a handful, like Google and Amazon are doing it, and us really. So it's nice that way. It's such a difficult space that it's going to be very, very valuable. But why did I start the business? I live in a suburb of Dublin, and it's absolutely impossible for me to reliably get a bag of chips of a Friday night.
Feel that.
Let me solve that problem first and see what else we can do, But yeah, I mean, long story short, personally, it's impossible for me to get reliable delivery. Size of the market, it's a $1 trillion market at least. So it's an attractive problem to solve, and that's where we are now.
I absolutely love it. So I live in an apartment complex just on the outskirts of Limerick City. I will say that getting deliveries is painful is a nice way to explain it. So because of the way the road is built, what ends up happening is delivery drivers end up around the back of the building, or yeah, they go yeah. to the spar shop across the road and go, well, just find me there. So yeah. which means it's like, hold on a second, if I'm going to get deliveries,
yeah,
don't make me go over to the shop to go and fetch it. If I wanted to go to the shop, I'd just go to the goddamn shop.
Yeah, it's hard for those guys to make it work. Like in tribute to them, those the big guys that just eat to deliveries and so on, they do a remarkably good job at actually getting this working, and they do provide an important service to that restaurant you got your chips from, right?
Yeah.
So they're bringing them demand, and it's just it's such a difficult problem to solve, because the truth of it is, you know, takeaway food, it's a low basket value thing. It's average 20 quid, whatever. Mm. So there isn't a lot of space in there for anyone to make money doing anything else other than making the product. So
it's a volume game.
Yeah, it's a volume game. And then it's a volume game using humans. Like, humans don't scale. It's just very hard to get them. It's a high cost to get them, to train them, you know. And it's just really hard to make it work from a business point of view. And then the humans themselves, you know, I get it, right? It's kind of, it's a great income stream for someone that has maybe university or something else going on. They can top up their funds doing a bit of delivery driving. Yeah, I get that, of course. But it's a thankless, low-paid, tough job that's, you know, not for everyone. And so I think those guys will always exist, and they'll always have an important role, particularly with the big parcels that we couldn't carry, so your groceries, things like that. But for the cup of coffee, which, by the way, is 30% of our volume, is just hot coffee, cappuccinos and so on. It's just not scalable to use people on the roads to do that.
Yeah, no, it makes sense, because you definitely see it, especially in the bigger cities like Dublin. And I was in London quite recently, and when you're going down the road, the amount of like Deliveroo bikes, Just Eat bikes, yeah. Uber cars and stuff like that, and you're like, the volume of these guys on the road is massive. If you could take a portion of them out of the busy streets.
Yeah, for sure. But like, again, you think, like most people do think about the urban centres, like middle of Dublin, middle of Limerick, Cork and so on. But what you really need to think about is the suburbs around those places, right? So think about, you know, Tala or Blanchardstown or any of those places where the demand density, the population density just isn't there to really support batching of orders. So in other words, the driver is likely going out with one meal on each journey. So they're having to come back from wherever they deliver to. So it's incredibly inefficient that driver is only active or productive half of the journey, right? Whereas in urban centers, like middle of Dublin, those drivers, if they're leaving Camiel Thai, they likely have three orders there, and they're doing the traveling salesman, you know, journey,
next house.
And that's how they make their business work. But that only works in city centers, and only works by shrinking the delivery radius as well. So, you know, yeah. So think differently about city centers than you would about suburbs.
No, this is really fascinating. So like, how exactly does it work, I suppose, is a really good question to ask. Because what I, you know, from seeing the videos and watching the social media channels, it seemed like you can get like 3 minute deliveries, which is nuts. So how does like the platform work from start to finish for a user journey, I guess, is a really good place to go?
Well, it's very straightforward. You download the Mana app, and we'll give you a list of restaurants within flight distance of your house. And that'll depend on the wind and how hard the wind is blowing. We'll sometimes shrink the radius. So the aircraft's capable of about a 20-kilometer flight, but you know, we'll probably fly mostly 3 to 4 kilometer max radius. So think about 7-8 kilometer round trip. Anyway, so the first time we've seen you, it's a normal shopping experience. You open the restaurant to your choice, you order your product. We'll limit you based on weight and volume of the cargo. That's probably the only difference with us is, you know, if you go over a new aircraft's 3.5 kilos and 30 liters volumetrically. So if you go over that, we'll warn you that that's going to require 2 aircraft rather than one, things like that. But then you check out. If it's the first time you've ever used the service, we'll ask you to drop a pin on the map where you want us to deliver. And that's a high res map. So most people would use their back garden, or some will use their front garden. Apartment blocks will use like a communal delivery area where they'll drop in, where they can all pick it up in the same place. And that's it then. You'll get a notification when the aircraft is taken off. You can track the aircraft as it's flying towards your house. And then when it arrives, it'll descend. It's going to arrive about 60 meters altitude. When it arrives over that pin, it'll descend to about 15 meters. It'll hover there and it'll winch the product down to the ground. And then, yeah, it's pretty cool.
Yeah, like the actually seeing it in action is class. Like, I remember, like, during COVID, we used to have a bucket on a string for the apartment, yeah. Which I'm sure looked ridiculous,
not bad, creative, yeah.
Honestly, it's going down three flights of stairs to a delivery driver who just leave it on the floor. So it's like, just put it in the bucket.
Yeah,
everybody was happy, but yeah. I've seen these things in action. Like, it's a really cool experience. You're seeing your food coming down from the sky. It's like this godly moment.
At night, especially, you know, you just see the blinking lights.
Yeah,
the house, you know, and we fly pretty fast. Like, we're flying at 90 kilometers an hour airspeed. And then we slow down, we spin around, like, we'll depend on the direction the wind is blowing in, we'll spin around to face into the wind for more stability. And so all these cool things happen. And then when we get lower, there's a big, huge spotlight comes on and lights up the ground in a circle. And that circle, you know, grows as the air, or shrinks, should I say, as the aircraft's getting closer to the ground. And then it's so cool. It really is. I mean, we have, in the last town in Oranmore, was 38% of the community used the service on a regular basis. Mm. And the NPS, or the Net Promoter Score, how people respond to the product, we hover between 80 and 90% satisfaction rating, which is higher even than Apple have for their own products. Like, everyone loves the service. Yeah. And it's part in multiple parts, right? It's super cool, obviously, but it works, you know, it's reliable. Yeah. It's on time. Your French fries or your ice cream hasn't melted, your French fries are still crunchy, your coffee's perfect. Like, it, because of the speed advantage that we have, it's very well received.
No, like, it, and the experience of it is cool. It's as you said, it works. That's the primary thing, is that it works, it functions. And then for me, like, with the time I saw it, it was like, you know, that kind of UFO coming down, but it's actually your food. And you're like, yeah, there's like this little bit of, I guess maybe it's a tech thing of going, you know, yeah, I got my food delivered by drone, not by a bicycle today. It wasn't that class.
Yeah, it's going to be extremely normal. You know, it's going to be, I mean, people in Balbriggan, where we've been operating of late, don't look up anymore when the drone's flying past. Like, I won't say they're bored with it, but it's just routine, right? So, and that's where we want to be. You know, we want to be at a place where local businesses benefit from the service, local consumers use it, and it's just delivery. It's nothing else, you know.
Yeah, we're actually getting a couple of questions here in live, so I think it'd be really good to pick up on one or two of these.
Yeah.
So I guess there's a good question here. So 62% of Oranmore's population don't use it. Presumably they're annoyed by the noise factor of a drone. I imagine that is something that is... you've actually taken into consideration.
Yeah, no, they're not annoyed at all. We've been operating now 3.5 years commercially. We've done 170,000 flights, and we have 16 complaints about the noise. And most of them were complaints when we weren't even operating. It was complaints about helicopters, and that happened to be in the space. Noise is not an issue for us. We actually make less noise than an electric car passing by. That question is a bit of a loaded one. The fact that 38% of the population use the service is a staggeringly high take-up rate, and significantly higher than people using road-based delivery. Like, the typical take-up rate of a big delivery player would be about 7%. And so we're 38%, so we're like 5 times more popular than road-based delivery. If anything, I think people that haven't used the service yet, it takes a long time for people to, you know, jump on board. There's early adopters of technology, then there's the normal, the median, and then there's a long tail of slow adopters. So I don't think that's noise hasn't been an issue. And our friends at Google Drone Delivery have been operating even longer than us, doing 20,000 deliveries a month in a suburb of Australia, get 5 or 6 complaints a month out of those 20,000 deliveries.
So very low.
Yeah, it is very low. If you hear it, like, we're not like normal drones. We like 30-inch props. It's actually, you don't even hear it when we're flying overhead, so that's not an issue.
Cool. There's two questions here that I think kind of fall under the same kind of pocket of regulations. And I think that's actually a really good topic to look at, especially in this space. So the first question is, you know, will your business lead to the blocking of public airspace for recreational drones so that you can operate safely? And the other question is very similar. Can a resident fly their own drone in the same airspace as your commercial drones?
Yeah, yeah. So there are two different, actually, there's two different answers there. The second one first, a resident flying their own drone, so a private user of a drone, there's very clear regulations around that, around certain permissions that you need to have the drone registered with the IAA. You need to be conspicuous. In other words, your drone has to be able to identify itself, and you can't fly beyond line of sight, which usually means within 15, 30 meters. And there's plenty of then small commercial operators that kind of had licenses to do beyond that. So like RTE, for example, with their drones for filming different events, things like that. So no, there's regulations in place clearly define how to share the airspace with each other. We don't require any exclusive access to the airspace. Quite the opposite. Europe has created these set of services called U-Space that allow for sharing and prioritization of air traffic. So, for example, ambulance, helicopter, police, drone, all of those things would have a higher priority than we'd have. And we'd be at a certain layer, being a commercial operator, that would have an equitable sharing of the airspace with everybody else. And the systems are in place to do that. The only difference with us is that we already have permission to fly beyond visual line of sight. In other words, one of our operators can manage multiple aircraft and doesn't need to be looking and have the aircraft visible. So we have a little bit more permission than most, but that's because we're, you know, commercial entity, 5 years under the belt, 175,000 flights, and have systems designed for that. But mm-hmm. No, I don't think the existence of neither us nor our competitors, like, I mean, Google Wing are operating in Lusk, most people don't know, and Terranure. Yeah, and we can happily share the airspace with them. So there's, you know, anyone who owns their own private drone, and I'm one of those people, there's no restrictions whatsoever on flying your drones that aren't beyond existing regulations.
Yeah, it seems like it's actually good to hear that, like, it's very regulated. You know, it means that you can't just have anybody come into the market. I mean,
it has to be. It has to be, because the airspace is very, it's, I won't say a very dangerous place, but it's a very important place. So there's big, huge aircraft up there with people in them, right? So you need real discipline and really clear rules and laws around what you are and aren't allowed to do. And the drone industry has two parts. It is professional, licensed commercial operators like us, and then it has the hobbyists and that side. And they should both exist. They've both good reason to exist. So you need clear regulations and rules to make sure that everyone, I won't say is forced to do the right thing, but understands what the right thing is to make sure that everybody is safe.
Sure. And on those kind of regulations, is there things like, Joe, like the height that you can fly it at, range you can fly at? This is one of these, it's upsetting to be from Limerick type season, I'm going to say, because I know that there's parts of the city where if they saw a drone low enough, you're going to see if you can take it down.
Yeah.
It's kind of like, what do those regulations look like in terms of height, range, safety, security, all those kind of factors?
Yeah. No, so we fly at a, you know, depends on where we're flying, right? If it's flat, if it's a flat area, we'll fly at about 60 to 70 meters. If it's got terrain on it, then we'll go at a constant height above barometric height, but that could result in 50 meters up over 100 meters, you know, above ground level. But the way to think about it in general is, look, general aviation, so helicopters, light aircraft, and so on, are not supposed to go below 1,000 feet.
Okay.
Our industry is not supposed to go above 500 feet. And anything above 500 feet in our space would be 150 meters. Anything above that would be, one, hugely irresponsible and criminal in our view, because you're putting at risk people in aircraft, right?
Of course. A
pilot, whatever. And the second one is, funnily enough, small aircraft with battery powered, they're not able to climb. You use a lot of energy. So there isn't really a use case that would put you very high up in the air.
Yeah,
that's legal, is what I would say, right?
Sure.
So it's there's an easy physical separation between, you know, normal traditional aviation and what we're doing, and it's easy for us to obey that too.
Cool. And in terms of like the safety factor, like I assume that range means it's high enough in the air that somebody essentially with a slingshot ain't going to be able to try take them down.
Yeah. So
I've seen the bodies as well. Like they're sturdy out.
Yeah, no, they're big drones, but they're sensitive too. I mean, you could get lucky or unlucky. You know, we have 8 props, 16 blades, and we can fly with just 4, right? So it'd take a good bit to, you know, to knock us out of the air. But at the same time, we have a parachute specifically designed for that. So if there's a total system failure for whatever reason, be it malicious or something else,
sure.
We have a parachute, and that will make sure that the aircraft lands or hits the ground safely, right? Or safely in a way that might damage the aircraft a little bit, but it's not gonna hurt anyone underneath. So all of that is there. And again, it's a serious crime for anyone to interfere with an aircraft, and we are covered by aviation laws. Not that that's gonna stop them, right?
Sure.
But I think like banks exist, people have guns, banks still exist, right? Our industry, of course, you'll have some fools that will do malicious things, like the people that fly into Dublin Airport with their drones. There's yep. idiots everywhere, and you just have to work around them some way.
Yeah, actually, that brings us on to another question from the audience. And it's actually pretty much fills into that space. So it's like, you know, safety policies, regulations to mitigate collisions with, for example, hobbyists. As this person says, some hobbyists aren't going to fly by the rules, 120 meters max. Some people aren't going to kind of follow that. So is there kind of...
Yeah, it's true. But I think regulations are very clear about what you are not allowed to do as a hobbyist and a commercial operator. And so we have conspicuity mandated now in Europe. So all of your aircraft must be conspicuous. In other words, we must be able to see them electronically, right? Mm-hmm. So that's one way that we can, even if you're breaking the rules, we know you're breaking the rules and we can avoid you. And that's called tactical deconfliction. And it's built into the standards, UTM standards for European airspace. So we can see you and we can avoid you, and we will report you to the authorities just like anyone else should do. So the thing is, if you're flying a private drone, you're not limited at all by the regulations. It's just follow the rules. There's no limits really, and we're not stopping you from flying. And I think the other part of this is the great DJI drones. I mean, most hobbyists will be using a DJI drone in mm-hmm. anyway. They're super machines, and I think their software can automatically restrict you from flying in controlled airspace or close to an airport or to restricted airspace. And I think that could go a bit further, and it could even render them unusable for malicious actors as well. And I think that's a step that it has not come yet, but it may very well come. So that if you want to break the law with your DJI, it could quite possibly be soon that you wouldn't even be able to, unless you hack it yourself, you won't be able to. So I think that's taken care of.
I mean, yeah, there's always going to be people, like I remember back in the day with the PlayStations, you know, you'd hear plenty of people getting them chipped and stuff so that they could download content and stuff like that. So like there's always going to be people who break the rules, but like when you have safety systems like that in place where you can avoid them, that's
the real danger is these idiots that take their DJI and they fly them up to 1,000 feet or 2,000 feet to take a great view of Dublin. That's really dangerous, and they can still do it. And those aircraft like ours, you can climb up to 1,000 feet. Of course you can. It's very expensive battery wise, but you can get up there and hang around there long enough. But that's criminal. And if anyone wants to do that, they need to understand that there's a quite possible risk of fatality by doing that if it collides with an aircraft.
Yeah.
You know, that's...
And at the moment, like we'll say around those regulations, like there isn't, like, well, let's say a hobbyist can't be prosecuted, charged with crimes at the moment, or am I incorrect in saying that?
No, they can be prosecuted, yeah. It's in the legislation. There was new laws signed in January of 2023 around this as well. They can be prosecuted. I don't think the stick is the right approach here. I think education is a better one. And the IAA, in the case of Ireland, IAA do a very good job. They invest significantly in education, in training, and documentation, all those things. I think that's the best approach, is just awareness and education. But the one of the issues is Christmas time, someone goes to Harvey Norman's, buys their kid a drone, and the kid is not educated. It's up to the parents to take that responsibility on. And one, I think an improvement to that could be just mandate the manufacturers, the OEMs, to say, look, our aircraft cannot break the laws. You just can't fly to 1,000 feet with this aircraft, even though physically it can.
There's no restriction once it hits a level.
There should be a way, and of course there can be a way where it's just physically impossible. And I think that's a gap that hopefully we don't have to require legislation for that. But if we do, it's technically very doable.
Yeah. No, like, I think it's a very interesting kind of space, because I personally wouldn't have known like the regulations that come around it. So I suppose it would be really interesting to kind of know like misconceptions, the common misconceptions around like this business, this industry. Cause I think even from my own, you know, when I started looking at you initially, I was like, they're just really big drones. This is cool. And then not thinking of all the other factors. So like, what are the kind of common misconceptions that you'd see or come up against from users or like authorities, etc.?
Look, if you it's very interesting. We did this in Oran Mór before we went there. We did a survey, and we didn't tell anyone who we were, nothing. So we just did a survey on, what do you think of drones? What do you think of drones used for restaurant delivery? I think those were the questions. And we got about 70% of the people said, yeah, we like that. About 20% said, we're not sure if we like this idea. And 10% said, we do not like this idea, right? And those 10%, their concerns were in order of concern, noise was the first one, privacy was the second one, job loss was the third one, and safety was the fourth one, right, in order.
Sure.
And so I'll answer those four shortly, but when we then rolled out the service to the town and we waited a year and we did the same survey again, we got a 98% positive rating. And so we went from 70 to 98%. And why is that? Because most of the perceptions, the negative perceptions that drive people's reluctance on embracing the service, come from a lack of understanding of what the true issues are around drones. So if I go through them, safety is the only one people should really genuinely care about. And there we have an answer. Look, commercial operators like us, even if we wanted to be cowboys, we can't be because of the regulator. The regulator inspects us, audits us, puts manners on all of us, right? So safety should not be a concern. The top one, though, noise. You can't hear our drones at cruise height as they go by. People don't look up when we fly over. And scientifically, we make less noise, less dBs than an electric car does on the road at 30 miles an hour. So that's privacy, not an issue. We have no customer data. Zero. You don't know your name, your phone number, nothing. And we record nothing. No cameras recording, nothing. So that privacy issue stems from abuse of hobby-grade drones, where people are flying their drones into their neighbor's house, looking in their window or whatever they're doing, right? But a commercial operator, it would be suicide to do something like that. So we don't do it. And then job loss is the interesting one, because there's definitely a case to be made where, look, when any new disruptive technology comes out, it will displace jobs, right? But it'll create jobs in other areas. And what I would say to that argument is, look, yes, there'll be less food delivery driver jobs, right? There'll be less guys on bicycles in piss and rain on Friday nights delivering hamburgers. But in exchange, the local restaurant, the local bookshop that we power has a better product than Amazon. The local coffee shop that we power has its business doubled and its average spend doubled when they get drone delivery. So by powering local businesses in suburbs with a delivery product that gets in 3 minutes to 150,000 people, you increase commerce locally. And if you increase commerce, you create jobs, and they're more sustainable jobs. They're better paid jobs. And so I think net net on the jobs front, drones are going to be a massive creator of jobs for any economy that uses them.
Yeah, no, the jobs one is, do you know what? This is one I've heard for years. Any tech related stuff, anything that's new, yeah. One of the first things that crops up every time is it's taking jobs. You hear it with AI, all especially at the moment. AI is like the buzzword of the industry. It's yeah. like AI is going to take our jobs. Like, no, they're tools to help support you. They're,
oh, yeah.
Like, it's like when people wanted the car. Okay, you're not grooming horses anymore. You transition and learn how to become a mechanic. It changes the jobs. It right. doesn't take them away. It changes
anything.
Them.
You can look back as far as the Industrial Revolution, where people complained that these machines were going to take away the jobs of guys that were using shovels to dig holes in farms and stuff like that. But it's on a different level. Any technology that is a big, huge change that empowers the human race to be more productive does, I would say, I wouldn't even say displace jobs. It just creates more commerce. It makes it easier to do business, faster to do business. It makes existing people more productive, and just everything gets better. There's so many studies of this, and we're no different. You know, removing a job that involves a human being sitting in a 3-ton car burning, you know, fossil fuels to carry a hamburger, you know, 5 miles, removing that job is clearly a good thing for the world. But that yeah. person who will no longer have that job can just as well work in one of the restaurants or businesses that we power that will be needing employees. So there's literally a direct connection between the jobs we create and the jobs we displace, like any technology. So I think, like, you only have to look at the operations we've powered already and look at the small businesses that we've powered to see we've particularly during COVID, but even prior to COVID, we just created so many jobs already.
Like, that's, yeah, no, it is. Like, one of the first interviews I did as part of the series was with James Flynn, and his product is like social media AI. And it's like, you know, I work in very directly in that space in marketing. And I was like, that's really cool, because that takes a task that would take me a lot, like a bit of time manually to go look at the data, da, da, da. And it just, here's some suggestions. Like, okay, I can now put this time elsewhere to something more productive where I can get more value. And that must be the same for the restaurants, like, and like other partners that you have. Cause I've seen, like, you work with Tesco, you work with, you know, some coffee shops you have, you know, yeah. It's not just here's your hamburger and chips. Like,
In Blanchardstown, we have, we will have when we switch it on, 24 of the biggest food brands, you know, and most of them are Irish food brands. And those brands struggle, particularly weekends, they struggle to get products delivered for them. And the result is they have a kitchen that's underutilized, right? They're only using their kitchen for half of the demand that's there because they just can't get it into people's hands, you know? So it's such a big win. And look, every vendor that, in every town that we've gone to so far bites our hands off to work with us, and rightly so. It's a product that gets them to, you know, more than 100,000 customers in a few minutes, and for a fraction of the cost that it cost them to do it. So this is such an important tool that's going to be really immensely valuable for small local businesses in the suburbs that we go to.
So I guess that lead me on to, like, we have set areas right now. How does, like, a company get on board with you guys? And then I suppose the next question is, where do you plan on going over the next year, 18 months? I suppose you can't call it a roadmap. It would have to be an air map for you guys. So what does the air map look like?
All going well. We're going to be in most of Dublin this year. So our plan is we want to season Blanchardstown a bit and make sure we're happy with the way things are going there, because each operation we do gets progressively bigger. So in Balbriggan was our biggest to date. We peak at about 200 or 300 deliveries a day, and Blanchardstown, just because of the size of it, we think it's going to be between 500 and 1,000 a day, and we'll be operating from 3 separate bases in Blanchardstown to cover the whole area. So that is by far the biggest drone delivery operation on the planet, and if we're happy with that, there's no we want it to be perfect before we go out any further. So I would think by the summer we'll start to roll out all the other Dublin suburbs and further afield as well. So that's the way to think about it in Ireland. Certainly by the end of the year, there'll be over 1 million people in Ireland will have access to the service, maybe 1.2 million. And then we are opening up. We've we're actively doing recce missions to three other European countries where we'd like to set up a footprint this year. So one large suburb. And then from 2025 onwards, we want to be scaling across Europe, all going well. And Europe, because Europe has the regulations that we need to do that. And our license, as it is now, give us permission to go anywhere in Europe. And then we've got our USA, our Texas operation too. And the Texas operation, that'll do, it's small. It'll do about 100,000 deliveries this year, but it's the start of our growth in the US.
Yeah. Yeah, I'd say the US is a very interesting market for that. I'd say, yeah, it's
because it is. Spend more. Our operation in the US now, I mean, I think we're already at 70%+ of the town use the service.
Yeah.
You know, and it took us 12 months to get to 38% in or more. You know, just the US, they're so commerce driven. But I don't think Europe will ever match the US in terms of consumption, anything like that. So we think that a typical suburb in Dublin, for example, about 40 or 50% of the community will use the service regularly and the rest won't bother. They prefer to walk to the store or drive or whatever. And that's fine. But when you ask there in that same question about vendors, the way we approach a new operation is if the new operation is Tala, and we'd work with the Chamber of Commerce there. We'd identify all of the vendors that are there and it's open to everyone. Literally anyone that wants to work with us can. They just need to get the product to us, right? So they either need to be at one of our bases or deliver the product to our bases. So if you want to bake delicious pastries and make that a business, we can make that a business for you. You just bake them, you just get them to our base and we'll fly them and sell them. And it works really well. So you don't need to rent a big lease in a main street store and hope that people walk by. You can literally become a digital online business with automated logistics overnight by partnering with us. So, and that's what we want to do. We want every big and small business to be in the system.
No, that's perfect. I really think this is the kind of business, you can see it. You hear Amazon drone deliveries. You see those kind of sci-fi type TV shows, drone in the window. I think this is it's an industry that's growing. It's an industry that's going to really go somewhere. Last year I was living in a suburb of Lisbon for a few months at Quinto de Ange. I am absolutely murdering the pronunciation, but it's an area called Palmela. It's just over the bridge in Lisbon. So for me to get into town or a delivery driver to get to me, it's 40 odd minutes. But it's in terms of distance, it's not that, but it's just the network. So you can definitely see scope in terms of those type of cities. It's the Paris, Lisbon, Madrid, where there's a big suburban circle around it where it's more access because of the road network than.
Yeah, I mean, we have such an advantage by flying. I mean, we're flying whatever. Our latest aircraft will fly to 24 meters per second. So about 90 kilometers per hour as the crow flies. And it doesn't have to wait for anything. And we have 3D, 3D airspace allocation with a time window on it. Yeah. So when you think about congestion or delays, for example, if there were too many drones and we needed to delay or anything, the airspace has so much bandwidth in it and our flights are so short that there's really no constraint on how many flights we could do. And when you think that one question that wasn't asked, I'm surprised I usually get asked it is, but what's it look like when there's thousands of drones in the air and the sky is dark with drones? It's not. The way to think about it is look at housing density in any given area and then look at order density, order frequency, overlaid on that housing density. And you end up with, in the case of Blanchardstown, at 1,000 deliveries a day with only 15 aircraft doing that. And that's across a 60 square kilometer area, so you're hardly ever going to see the aircraft. And when you do, there'll be one or maybe two of them you'll see, and they'll be no bigger than a seagull, there isn't this dystopian future where it's going to be nonstop drones zipping past. That's not going to be the case at all.
Yeah, you're not going to see this highway of drones going zoom, 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 zoom. Yeah, no. Look, I suppose that's one of those ones the sci-fi movies, the TV shows, they always give that impression. Yeah. But then again, that's always been the same.
There's a Paw Patrol episode about it. You can find that on YouTube. Yeah, the dystopian future per Paw Patrol. It's quite a good one.
No, I enjoy it. I have a niece and nephew. There's an excuse to watch one. So, yeah. Actually, two nieces. There's another one out. Yeah. No, like, I like the idea of the drone delivery. I think there's major scope in it. I suppose the last question I think I have is right now you're working with restaurants, like short distance. Is there scope in the future to do like longer form deliveries? You know, things like, I don't know, just off the top of my head, something like the medical space, like hospital,
yeah,
and that kind of stuff. Like, what does that look like? Sure. Or is that...
I think there are. We've chosen high frequency, high adoption products first because that, you know, for... To deploy infrastructure, to make the capital efficient, you need a lot of volume, you need a lot of utilization, right? So no, it's just like, you know, if you're an airline and you get a 737, you know, very few airlines do cargo. And the reason they don't do cargo is you don't get the utilization, you know, that you need. So they pay passengers and they use pricing to make sure the aircraft's full. And we're no different. We're an infrastructure, and infrastructure needs high utilization. So therefore, we use hot food, coffee, grocery, you know, things that lots of people need and lots of people get frequently. And that makes it business very, very viable. Later on, as we roll out, there's nothing to stop us. And we fully intend to have urgent delivery, right? So urgent delivery could be blood supply between the hospitals. It could be tests going to labs from hospitals, yeah, with responses going back. It could be like we have in Balbriggan, a defibrillator service. So you hit a button, you get a defibrillator. You post, if you think about high priority post,
yeah,
something like a document, a contract that needs to get from city center to Dundrum quickly and back again. Those are all use cases. Of course, we can solve. We can remove those motorbikes off the road. We can do all sorts of stuff we could do, but we won't do them yet until the service is fully rolled out and it's an infrastructure that's there to be used. Then we will make that infrastructure available to every use case. There's no reason we wouldn't. And so I think when society looks at what we're doing, yeah, it's a bit frivolous to use the airspace for, you know, burgers and coffee. But what they should really be thinking about is, look, this is an infrastructure to help society move stuff efficiently from A to B. And yeah, and taking some traffic off the road and taking some CO2 out of the air. And you can use that infrastructure for most things.
That's a great way to look at it. It's like, it is like right now where we're at is like ground zero. It's like that initial 10% that's showing how it works, why it works, getting people used to,
yeah,
a product, something so new to the industry or just so new to transport in general. And it's like, as that becomes more recognized, you're going to get more adoption in terms of like medical space, business space. I think the medical space is going to be the one that really gets value.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, I mean, certainly for critical importance, that's the space. And there's other cases that we've heard, like for example, for chemotherapy medicine delivery, that needs to be delivered on a motorbike from the manufacturer to be administered very, very quickly. Another great one was for helping paramedics. So paramedic arrives at a scene and there's blood loss, we could get blood to the scene instantly, you know, literally 100 kilometers an hour as the crow flies. There's all sorts of really useful cases, but on their own, nobody could afford to solve those cases because there just isn't enough frequency for that to be a viable business. And there's no way government or HSE would ever be able to do something like that. They need something like us to exist and to have the capability to do it. And once we do and we're ubiquitous, then I definitely see us being used for all of those use cases.
That's amazing. I don't think I have any questions left. There's been some cool questions from the audience. Is there anything else that you feel like I've missed in terms of talking to you today that you feel like now is a good chance to say it?
No, I think that was comprehensive. But I'd like to say it's really great to see the audience engagement there. Those questions coming in, it's very important. You know, Mana is a very open and collaborative player in terms of the local community with all the stakeholders. And the stakeholders that we see ourselves, we see the regulator, we see the community, the local community, we see the uninvolved people we fly over. So people not using the service, we have to have a lot of respect for them. And the process of doing something like this, answering difficult questions all the time, honestly and openly, I think is that's important. And so thanks for the opportunity to do that here, answer the audience's questions. And look, you know where to find me. Find me on LinkedIn or Twitter or whatever. You can harass me with your questions there. You'll find that I'm delighted to answer questions no matter how difficult they are, you know, at all levels. And look, the line is open anytime anyone wants to ask a question.
So what are the channels? Manage Your Own Delivery across Instagram, Twitter?
I think I love Twitter. Most people aren't on Twitter because it's a swamp. LinkedIn or Twitter are probably the best. But if you want a private question, you know, just email straight into Mana. We have on the website, you'll see the address there, mana.aero website. And you can answer a question in confidence. You can get a question answered in confidence there. But if you want to, you know, have a public question answered, then by all means, LinkedIn or Twitter is fine.
Class. Yeah, no, what I'll do is when I put the post out later on this evening, I will put a link there back to the brand page on LinkedIn and stuff like that. For now, Bobby, thank you so much. It's been wonderful to talk. I love the idea of drone delivery, so I'm really excited to see where you're going to be next year.
Thanks for having me.
And from our side, we're no longer on Twitter because it's a dark and scary place, and wow. I've done my time. I've worked in social media for years. I need to see no more. So we're across TikTok, we're across Facebook, Instagram. We're actually on Threads as well, so you'll find us goose_ie on all of those platforms. Threads is a really cool place to be right now, so have a look at that yourself.
That's all I need to hear. I've been circling around it. I'll give it a go.
The GDPR legislations have all been concerned and sorted. So, that's where you'll find us. And in the meantime, everybody who's listened, everybody who's contributed, thank you so much for your time, and we'll see you next time. Bye.
Take care.